Good morning, it's 8 o'clock. You're listening to KVNF Mountain Grown Community Radio. This is regional news for the Western Slope. I'm Travis Bubinick. BLM officials say they've found a new temporary location for the agency's Gunnison field office after that building was vandalized and set on fire a couple weekends ago. In a statement, the BLM said the former Gunnison office would be closed indefinitely. Staff from the Gunnison office are currently working out of a nearby U.S. Forest Service location, and the agency says it hopes to be fully operational at a new location in early January. Vandals reportedly broke into the office after 3 a.m. two Saturdays ago, damaged some of the interior to the building, and then set it on fire. Authorities have determined the fire was intentionally set, and a BLM vehicle was found outside the office gates just blocks away. Authorities, meanwhile, haven't yet released any motives for the crime or named any suspects. A new study from the University of Colorado Leeds School of Business shows that it may be difficult to quantify how droughts, fires, and floods are impacting the state's economy over the long term. But it's safe to say natural disasters are already influencing public policy and are requiring communities to shift their thinking. Benta Berkland has more from the state capitol.
The majority of Colorado's most deadly and devastating wildfires have occurred in the last decade. Figures also show that the frequency of wildfires is increasing each year. Tom Zwirlin is a finance professor at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. He says the cost of a wildfire varies radically.
The more we intrude upon the forests, the more of an economic impact that the fires are going to have.
The state is trying to grapple with the fact that more and more people are moving into the wildland-urban interface, commonly called the WUI. Some lawmakers have called for a building ban in certain parts of the state, but a legislative committee studying wildfires wasn't willing to propose a statewide building code. Bob Eichem is with the city of Boulder.
So it's going to be an ongoing policy debate. There are many places that have enforce new rules, new regulations. Others say, you know, leave it alone, government. You're on your own.
Lawmakers are proposing a tax credit to help people pay for fire mitigation. The state also wants to give counties more authority to require tree removal in fire-prone regions. Professor Zwirlin says mitigation can mean the difference between a house burning down or remaining intact. But he thinks homeowners will continue to pay a price for living in the WUI.
The cost of insuring a home is going to increase. The insurance companies are taking a close look at the disasters that have occurred in Colorado over the last several years. Premiums are just, in general, going to rise over time.
Zwirlin says the 2002 Hayman fire is still the state's most expensive to date, at a cost of $200 million. Still, with fires, floods, and droughts, it's difficult to assess the economic losses. Businesses aren't required to report them, and it takes a long time for communities to determine how much sales taxes are hurt. Bob Eichem urges towns and cities to be cautious as they recover.
Because you need to separate it and say, these are ongoing revenues that are going to match our ongoing costs. We're going to use those one-time monies to pay for one-time costs, such as pay-as-you-go capital, infrastructure, refinancing. And that is where cities and communities really have to start learning how to separate the types of funds they get coming in.
And it's not just wildfires. The Department of Agriculture says September's floods, coupled with several years of drought, will force farmers and ranchers to take a hit. Ron Carlton is with the Colorado Department of Agriculture. He says long-term, the state is most worried about making sure farmers and ranchers have enough water. The state's population is projected to double in the next 20 years.
That's going to put enormous pressures on water and agricultural land. We're already looking at projected gaps between supply and demand in all of our basins and how we're going to meet those needs and continue to ensure that we have productive agricultural lands without taking water off the land is going to be, you know, a real challenge.
Many of these issues are expected to come up during next year's legislative session, which begins in January, although no one anticipates solutions anytime soon. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
Capital coverage is funded by Pikes Peak Center, Colorado Springs. Presenting an evening with Garrison Keillor, the ambassador for Lake Wobegon. Tickets now on sale at all Tickets West locations or pikespeakcenter.com.
When you think of moving to a housing development in the suburbs, you might imagine golf courses, swimming pools, and rows of identical houses. But that could be changing. There's a new model springing up across the country that taps into the local food movement. Farms, complete with livestock, vegetables, and fruit trees, are serving as the new suburban amenity. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
Stephanie Sison walks through Ponderosa Park in the town of Basalt. She holds in her hands a planning map for the half-acre plot.
So the entrance will be over there.
Circles on the map show where plum, apple, and nectarine trees will be planted. A plot for mushrooms is adjacent, and a seed-saving garden sprawls at the forest entrance.
The central area being the tree section, which will be cleared a bit in the understory and left to natives, so all native edibles will be added in as the understory.
All the amenities sound like they could be part of a community garden, but this is different. The concept is pretty simple. Planners recreate a forest ecosystem with edible plants and trees in a public space. Then you open it up and allow people to forage for food for free.
It is a forest. It is a park, but it's all edible. So the whole community can come in and sit under the apple tree and eat from the apple tree.
Or Sison says pick mushrooms or tomatoes or walnuts. Compare that to a community garden, which gives growers the mindset of personal ownership.
My row, my tomatoes, you know, I tend it, I take care of it, I harvest it, I take it home. This is just everyone's.
Sison's employer, the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, is partnering with the town of Basalt to pay for and maintain the food forest. Basalt serves as a small bedroom community for the affluent ski resort in nearby Aspen. The town's horticulturalist, Lisa DiNardo, says she hopes the food forest can serve as common ground within the community.
And this is where we need to go. This is one way to build bridges in communities. It's through a food network, for a healthy food network.
That robust network plays into the food forest's location, within walking distance to the town's elementary, middle, and high schools, and across the street from a predominantly Latino trailer park community. DiNardo says up in the mountains, food security is a huge issue, and that has people thinking about what they eat. A couple years ago, a blizzard and subsequent avalanches cut off road travel. Produce trucks couldn't make it into the isolated mountain towns.
There was a big storm, went into City Market, and literally the shelves were empty. And I think that was an impetus for people, growers, to really start thinking about it. You know, what can we do locally to bridge the gap?
The forest represents a shift in the way towns and cities think about their public spaces, but it's still an experiment.
Trees take a long time to establish and get both looking nice and producing food.
Don Thilmany studies local food system economics at Colorado State University.
So I think that's why they're taking a different tact and not having individual owners, but seeing it truly as a community asset to share, similar to a park system or a trail system or streets and roads.
Thilmany says she can't help but be cynical about the idea of opening up the forest completely. What happens when someone picks all the apples at once, or teens trample all the tomato plants?
I do think there will be some challenges from people who wonder, how much of that fruit crop do I own?
So I'll be fenced, the whole thing.
The forest's main proponent, Stephanie Sison, says she's not worried about the park being overrun by ambitious harvesters. Sure, the park will be open 24/7, but Basalt is a small town, and people in small towns talk.
The more open we are, we can kind of combat the one or two people that might have some malicious intent. It just won't be cool. And if it's not cool, they probably won't do it. So it'll be cool to come here and eat.
Plus, Sison says, the trees won't be bearing fruit for a couple years. Plenty of time to educate scofflaws about how this food forest actually works. I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of KUNC and other public media stations in the Midwest. You can find more stories or comment on this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Members of the Grand Junction Airport Authority Board say they're beginning to dig up clues into federal accusations of fraud being lodged against the airport. As the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports, the board launched its own investigation into the issue after federal agents searched the airport's administrative offices last month. The federal investigation is closed to the public, but board member Rick Wagner has said the internal investigation has found some hints as to where the fraud allegations might have stemmed from. Airport Aviation Director Rex Tippetts has in the meantime been put on paid administrative leave pending the fraud investigation. Airport Authority members still aren't saying exactly what they've discovered that might have prompted the federal search. And Democrats have selected a replacement for State Senator Evie Hudak of Westminster. As Bent DeBerkland tells us, Hudak resigned to avoid a potential recall election over her support for stricter gun laws.
A 73-member vacancy committee selected Arvada City Councilwoman Rachel Zenzinger to fill the Senate seat. She describes herself as center-left and beat out Democratic challenger and former state lawmaker Sarah Gagliardi. Zenzinger has served on the Arvada City Council for the last 3 years. She says she wants to focus on the tough issues facing the state, such as job creation, education, transportation, and health care. She'll join a Senate in which Democrats hold a one-seat majority. Two Democrats were recalled earlier this year over their support for stricter gun laws. I'm Benta Berkland in Jefferson County.
You're listening to KVNF Mountain Grown Community Radio. This is regional news for the Western Slope. Stay tuned for the Wednesday morning music mix. For KVNF News, I'm Travis Bubinick.